Well, thanks very much, David. It's nice to be here. Nice to see you in the job. I've had the pleasure of working with David on some projects when I was in business, and it's really good to see you in this capacity. You'll do a great job. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm standing between you and a drink after all the proceedings today. But the topic I have got is a very important one, I think, and many of you would be very familiar with the dynamics of what is called the skills crisis, and we hear a lot about it. But really, in essence, it starts with a labour shortage, and that is driving, in turn, a lot of the skills crisis or the skills shortage that we've got. And to me, it is sort of a combination of what is now nearly 14 years of uninterrupted economic growth, an ageing population, and in many ways the profound emergence of China and India. There are other factors, but to me, those three things in combination have brought about what is, in many respects, a 21st century phenomena. It's now becoming conventional wisdom that we could all see this coming and all the rest of it, but and I did a lot of work with the mining companies, as I mentioned, in the turn of the century, this century, and I did have access to strategic work for some of those different big companies, and I had access to a lot of their serious forecasting work that they do. Some of them got whole buildings full of people doing that sort of thing in the Prague and elsewhere. And I saw in 2000-2001 no suggestion amongst any of those companies of what has ultimately happened in China and India, and many of you would be very conscious of that. So my sense is if the big resource companies, the big energy companies who are in every market in the world, exploring, understanding the politics, all the rest of it, if they had no sense of what's coming down the line at us, and anyway, all I'm saying is it's there, we've got to deal with it, it's profound, it's got lots of opportunities, lots of threats, but, it's important to recognise that it is a new phenomenon. The whole ageing issue, we did know that was coming, but again, I think many parts of the community had not focused, even today, which Vicky in the Victorian Chamber did a survey recently, and it blew me away. 64% of the businesses surveyed thought that there was no issue with an ageing population for them, for their business. And yet the majority of those businesses had a majority of their staff over 50. Majority of the 64% had a majority of their staff over 50, and they saw no issue coming down the line. I mean, it is something that we need to be realistic about what's out there. And the fact of the matter is, last year, every day, on average, 530 more people entered the working age group, not the workforce necessarily, but the working age group. Every day, on average, the next 530 more entered it than left it. And we've got the problem we have got now, with 530 a day net increase. It is anticipated, if you look at Peter Costello's work, that in 8 years' time, even with the current high levels of migration, which are record levels, we will have 160 people net increase in the working age group each day. So from 530 back to 160 in the space of the next 8 years. So you put all these things together and, you know, we've got an issue now to deal with, but a lot of what we do now has got to position us to deal with an even more difficult situation in terms of available labour and the consequent impact it has on skills. So, it is a phenomena across the OECD, which also brings other dimensions to this thing. Last year, as David said, I had responsibility for multicultural affairs and related matters, and it brought into stark light for me the fact that a lot of the migration that we've had 50 years of great success as a country with migration into Australia. But a lot of that migration, the integration, the very effective integration, has come about because a lot of the people came from cultures not that far removed from ours. They might not have spoken English, but a lot of European immigration and all the rest. Now a lot of the immigration, both into our country but also into other OECD countries, to fill and to cope with a lot of the labour shortages, are coming from cultures that are far removed from ours. And China, for instance, 10 years ago didn't even rate its own line. It was in the other category. It's now our third biggest source of migrants, skilled migrants. 200,000 from the Middle East and Africa in the last few years. Now, we will deal with this, but it is, again, for business and for the community generally, there are all these other related issues associated with the ageing of the population and the impact of China and India and uninterrupted economic growth on the impact on our business, on our communities, and all the rest of it. Now, just I thought I'd give you a sort of overview, if I would, of where, as a government, we're trying to influence. So, of course, the business has taken a lot of its own initiatives, the community's taken a lot of its own initiatives, but as a government, how are we seeking to deal with and facilitate a response to all of this? The fact is, I think there's, like in business, there's no silver bullet. You've got a problem, usually it's got many parts to the solution. And as from my observation, the solution to dealing with coping with this labour and skill shortage covers many policy fronts. Welfare to work, workplace reform, taxation, superannuation, independent contractor legislation, skilled migrants, temporary skilled migrants, and a range of other portfolio initiatives. And we have been, if you look back over the last 3 years in particular, that has dominated our policy agenda. All of those issues, and most of them, most of the key policy issues, the skill shortage and the emerging problems has been front and square in the motivation and the need for a lot of that. And there are really three broad areas, that broad fronts that we are working on. The first is that we are trying to get anyone who can work into work or to stay in work. Sounds a fairly basic proposition, but that's a really critical one, trying to get anyone who can work into work or to stay in work. And it's driven by the observation that there are large pockets of untapped labour resources in Australia at the present time. We've got 700,000 people on disability pensions. We've got 750,000 people on parenting payments. We've got 490,000 people still on unemployment benefits. We've got 3 million Australians who are between the ages of 55 and 70. And we've got a quickly growing young Indigenous population. So again, for certain sectors, mining and agriculture in particular, that is a really important future source of labour in certain areas of the country. Now, the sort of policy responses are seeking to untap some of that untapped labour. I mean, the work choices, the workplace reform, the unfair dismissal, for instance, in my view, has driven, without qualification, has driven the 22% reduction in the long-term unemployed. That has been a figure that's a really sticky figure. You think back over 15 years, very hard to move the long-term unemployed back into the workforce. In the last year, 22% reduction in the long-term unemployed because businesses, and in the main a lot of small businesses, are able to say, I can take the risk with somebody, looks good, but hasn't had a job for 8 years. He's 27, never had a job, but looks okay, looks motivated. I can take the risk because if it doesn't work out, I can move them on. And as a consequence, we're seeing, writ large, across the economy, a lot of people, a lot of women who are on parenting payments, who want to work, need to work for their own self-esteem, to stay in the workforce, maintain skills, or when they can go into full-time workforce, but have been denied opportunities, again for the same reasons. Ken Henry said, in response to the tax changes and the welfare changes that were made in the most recent budget, that it will lead to an extra 90,000 people into the workforce in the next year because of the interaction between welfare payments and tax. It is a requirement to tackle this on a whole lot of fronts, and we are seeking to do that. The second thing we're trying to do is to encourage those entering the workforce, but also those in the workforce, to value technical and vocational and creative training in a way that academic training is valued. We made a big mistake as a community in the last 20 to 30 years when we talked down the trades. And there has been. It's got to a point where technical and vocational training in the minds of many people is seen as a second-class career. And we've got a situation, I think, where many parents feel they've failed if their children don't go off to university. That's a fact. That is what's in the minds of many people in the country. It's a cultural development over the last 20 to 30 years, which I think is really now starting to impact on our ability to deal with this skills issue. The fact of the matter is that with the current economy and the way in which, you know, the level of technology and the need to respond as, to the opportunities and the threats that are there, it is anticipated that we'll need about 20% of the workforce with a university education. Currently, we've got about 20% of the workforce with a university education. That's in balance. It is anticipated we'll need about 60% of the workforce with a high-quality technical or vocational education. Currently, we've got 30% of the workforce. There's a huge gap in that area, and I think one of the things is a cultural issue. Unless we value technical and vocational education, you go to Germany, a master artisan, master tradesperson has got the status of a judge or a professor. You know the answer here. They're now making a lot of money, but, you know, it has been seen as a second-class career. And I do think that there's a lot we can do. As everyone in this room, you know, we've got leaders in this room. A lot of it is what we say. It's what people like myself and people like yourself and other leaders of industry, it's what we say, other leaders in the community, about the importance of valuing high-quality technical education as much as an academic education. We're all born with different skills and talents. And if we've got strong academic, develop those, make the most of them. But if we've got, most of us are actually born with better or stronger technical and vocational and creative talents than academic. And yet we closed every technical high school in the country in the last 20 years. And as a consequence, one of the things we're doing as a government, last election we promised to open because they weren't opening, and the technical education is still a state responsibility, but we promised to open 25 Australian technical colleges. They're old-style technical schools. They're year 11 and 12. They've got an industry board. They give the young people year 12 certificate, but they're one-third of the way through an apprenticeship when they finish that year 12. They've had 2 years in the workforce. They've earned while they've learnt. But most importantly, they've been in an environment, a technical school environment, where their talents and the focus of the course and all the rest of it is celebrated and focused on, right? So we are, and you go to some of these schools in Townsville and Port Macquarie, we've got 20 open now in the 18 months since the legislation passed, and you can see these young people bursting with pride. They've got the uniform on, Australian Technical College, the parents are full of pride, the grandparents at the openings, because they are giving effect, they're giving expression to the talents they've been born with, and they do feel valued. It's really important that we feel good about what we're doing. And I can't overstate this enough. I think it's so critical that we do, as a community, start to reposition the goalposts in terms of how we view these technical and vocational areas. And it's why we're doing a lot to keep young people in apprenticeships. I won't go through all the initiatives and things we're doing, but we've got wage subsidies that we're now paying to apprentices in their first 2 years, and fee subsidies and things, because in a four-year apprenticeship we're currently losing about 42% of all those that start, 42%. But 38 of that 42 leave in their first 2 years because they're mates. You know what it's like, young generation, there's another 5,000 in a warehouse down the road, unskilled job, they're off. Because they go to the footy on Saturday, they haven't got as much money as their mates who are in that. They're not looking forward. We've got to say to them, what you're doing is valuable, and what it's good for you, but it's also good for the community, and it makes the most of what you're good at. So the third area. So we've got getting people into work who can be in work or to stay in work, the 55 to 70-year-olds. And finally, we've got, and critically, the need to train and retrain those who are already in the workforce. We've got 3.4 million of the 10 million in the workforce who have not finished school or have no technical training of any consequence. 3.4 million. We've got a third of the workforce really with no training of any consequence. We've got mature age workers who we want to encourage to stay in the workforce. You go to Bunnings now. To me, it's a great experience. You know, I can remember when I was younger and had to, you know, do the house renovations and all the rest. It was such an excruciating experience to go on Saturday morning and try and, you had no idea on quantities and quality and all the rest of it. You'd waste hours. You go there now, Bunnings is full of former tradesmen and women. People that can no longer physically probably crawl around the roof and do the plumbing or whatever they were. But at 50, they get a 4-week training course. Bunnings put them through a retail course. They're in there, they've got the expertise, they've got the motivation, there's a flexibility in the work. They want to get in the caravan and go away for 6 weeks. It's accommodated, right? They've got a mindset of taking that expertise, retraining it, using, leveraging what they are good at, giving them another skill set and putting them in a situation where they feel immensely good about what they're doing. And you can tell it. They're there. They're telling you things you don't know. They're helping you enormously. It's a great experience, and you can get a cup of coffee with it. But so what I'm saying to you is that they're the three major areas. Now, but critically, this last one, I want to talk a little bit more about how do we train people and retrain people throughout the workforce, because it's a critical issue. If we are to overcome that skill gap, young people are still going to be coming in big numbers in the next few years and forever. But if we don't train and retrain, we've got a real problem, because a lot of the response to a skill shortage and a labour shortage is a reliance on technology, and you know that. But the existing workforce has to be able to manage and cope with that technology. And we, again, have got a cultural problem. There's such a mindset in our community that you do your training at the end of school and that's it. Now, we have to turn it around, and I know from the survey work and other work done, there's a lot of business people running businesses who feel they've failed if they have to have their people or themselves trained. When, in fact, the mindset should be, I'm failing if I'm not constantly looking at training opportunities. And again, it's what we mean by training. People don't understand at older age that it doesn't mean a 3-year diploma or apprenticeship. It may do if you want to, but it doesn't have to. A lot of it is just the building blocks approach to adding to people's skills, going back, getting a 4-week course or bringing it into the workplace. It was brought home to me in a most profound way recently, the reliance on technology. Years ago, 20 years ago, I was Executive Director of the Cattle Council of Australia, which is a group representing Australian cattlemen. I got some good friends all over the north on cattle stations. My wife and I went to see one of them a few weeks ago, Saturday night, to have a drink. We got to his property off the main road up in the Territory, a couple of hours from Alice, and his homestead is about 20 minutes off the road. Now, it used to be full of horses. That was the horse paddock. You know, it was a 10,000-acre horse paddock. And we got in there, and I'm having a drink. I said, I didn't see any horses. Where are the horses? He said, I haven't got any horses. Not a horse on the place. Got 8,000 head of cattle still. Big property, or average property there. No horses. He said, it's all helicopters and small aircraft to do all the mustering. A couple of motorbikes, but not many of those because of the unions have moved into safety and health and all the rest of it. So the insurance costs are through the roof. But here he is with helicopters and all the rest. We've had a drink. He said, I want to take you down to the yards. Huge set of yards, 8,000 head of cattle. And he's got this, I want to show you the new cattle crush, you know, where you contain cattle to do the mounting and whatever else you're going to do to them. And I go down there, here's a $400,000 cattle crush. And keypads, just a magical piece of equipment. And all the gates open automatically, all the way back up the race, all these things. And I said, well, where are all the cattlemen, you know, ringers, as they're called? And he said, I haven't got any ringers on the place. I don't have any So I've got 8,000 head of cattle, his son who's 40, and himself. And he said, with this sort of equipment, this technology, I use backpackers, German and Swiss and other backpackers. The whole cattle station runs with backpackers and technology and pilots. Right? But he's a pilot and his son's a pilot, so they do most of it. And I said, where's the romance? You know, I mean, there's no horses and there's no cattlemen. You know, what's going on here? We've got all these backpackers. But it just shows you what... Now, if that's happened in, you know, the middle of the Northern Territory, you know, what's going on across our industry and everywhere else? You know, it's just unbelievable what's happening. And it just brought home to me how the technology and the response to that. And my sense... I've had 14 weeks in this job and my keen sense of where the big hits are in the months and years ahead is, one, to change the culture in a fundamental way. Not only, you know, the culture, the way in which we view technical training per se, but also when we get trained and how we get trained. And that comes to all the training providers as well. Changing their mindset is probably one of the most important things about what's made available. But much of that training to accommodate the technology will be skill sets. So people who come in with a three-week course, the Bunnings people, a four-week retail course, someone comes in to learn the technology, and for a lot of the people, those pockets of untapped labour, a lot of them haven't got the confidence to actually even go and do a course. If they can go and do short courses, fill a skill set, go and get a job and do that, get some confidence, then they go and do something else. But the training's got to be available in these sort of different modules that can be accessed and take account of the fact that these people have got little kids and they're a sole parent or they're in the workplace and can't head off to a four-wall classroom approach at a TAFE, you know, an hour and a half or 20 minutes or whatever away and sit up there on all day Thursday and do the training as part of it. It's just got to... And you might think that's silly. It's not. All over the country, this is what we're confronting. We've got a multi-billion dollar resource in TAFE. It's 75% of our vet... infrastructure, and it is sitting there all choked up with regulation, red tape and history, and it is something of great consequence, and I'll come back to it in a second. But I think the need to build this building blocks approach, so someone does their 4 weeks or their 6 weeks or their 6 month course and they come back 2 years later, that piece of work is recognised and the experience that they've had in between is recognised. So there's ability to recognise competency and experience, and therefore, and the next piece of training is recognised. So you can put these building blocks and they've got something. One of the industries is developing a passport, an education passport, so you can tick off different skill sets and you can go to an employer and they can say, ah yes, I'm a mining operator, you've got ability to drive a shovel. Nothing else, but that's what you can do. That's a critical job, okay? You do that for 12 months and you want to do something else, I'll help you train and do something else. But it is this mindset of building blocks, and I think you've got to demand it. As industry, as business, you've got to demand it, and people like me have got to talk about it and do what we can with initiatives to encourage it. And one of the initiatives we're doing, last year we in October, we launched a package of skills for the future designed to meet the sort of existing workforce. And we had a voucher, $3,000 voucher, which goes to individuals in the workforce who haven't finished school and haven't got any serious technical training. It is working its socks off. We are now double what we expected demand after 4 months of operation of these vouchers. We're getting close to 20,000 vouchers. People take the $3,000 voucher and they go to a training provider, whether it's TAFE or whether it's an individual private provider, and can do courses, all sorts of short courses, longer courses, Cert 2, they can do Certificate 2 with that amount of money. But also they can bundle it up. So if you're an employer at Emerald and you've got 40 staff, at Emerald in central Queensland, and you can put it together, 40 staff times 3,000, 120,000, you can go down to Brisbane, say to the TAFE or a training provider, what can you do? Here's what my needs are. What can you do? When can you do it? How can you do it? And by the way, it's out there at Emerald, and we've got accommodation for your team. Now, this opens up, in my view, endless possibilities for flexibility and responsiveness in training. And, I think going forward, for government at least, one of the ways in which we will, in all sorts of different guises, I think put the power of the purchase in the hands of the individual or the companies and give them a capacity to drive the training response from all of the training providers, which brings me, and I'll finish on this. Again, in strategic terms, if you're looking with a business, you're trying to get somewhere. In this area, we're trying to solve a skills problem. Where are the big hits? Where can we make serious inroads into it? I've just talked about one, getting that flexibility, but how do we do it when 75% of our infrastructure is tied up in a TAFE sector? To me, the biggest microeconomic reform in the education sector by a country mile, and probably one of the biggest across the economy, is to breathe life into our TAFE sector. We've got 74 institutions across 1,300 campuses around the country. It's a wonderful resource and a lot of good people in it. You only have to look at Victoria. In Victoria, there is a model. In the 90s, Jeff Kennett came in. Economy is a basket case. Jeff said, I'm going to give autonomy to the TAFEs. The TAFEs in Victoria have now gone from the back of the line to the front of the line, and they're so far out in front it doesn't matter. 60% of all of the foreign student money in VET is in Victoria. All of the innovation, large, there are other examples of TAFEs around, and there's things happening, but overwhelmingly, we've still got a situation in a number of states, most states, where TAFEs are seriously choked with red tape. You've got $100 million plus businesses where if the person running it wants to go overseas to set up some business partnership or go to a course or attend a conference, have to get the approval of the minister. You're running a $100 million business in New South Wales and you want to get on an aeroplane and go to Malaysia to attend an international conference on your area of expertise, your business, you have to write in and get approval of the minister to buy that airplane ticket. Now, this is an example of the sort of, in every area of their business, that's what's happening. These sorts of, it's nonsensical. And to me, we need to give the TAFE sector a level of autonomy at least equal to that enjoyed by the universities. If we're going to see technical and vocational training as on a par with university, just different, then they need to operate with the same levels of autonomy and the same approaches. And it is, as I say, one of the great opportunities for very rapid and very important change. The dead cat on the table in all of that, it is the unions. And they are instructing the states to maintain that choking control. Jeff Kennett did it at a stroke of a pen. It is possible to do it. And yet in all the other states, some progress is being made, some like New South Wales, hardly at all, but in others it's all at different stages. The thing holding them back, and I've been meeting with the state ministers, privately they all admit it. They all admit it, and that it makes sense to give autonomy, by all means be very transparent, very accountable, but autonomy. But they know it, and they can see with Victoria what's happening. The runs are on the board, and I think it's why in this election, and I say this is not a partisan comment, the fact that the unions will be front and square, it is why the unions are front and square in this campaign. It is what impact, what control, what measure of influence do they exert over state Labor governments and the federal government? And if you get wall to wall, what the implications of that? And I know in Victoria, with all the success of the Victorian TAFEs, the Victorian government in the last 6 months have moved to implement a binding enterprise agreement across all TAFEs in Victoria. So even things like dual campuses, Swinburne, Ballarat and all these others, will not be able to approach their staffing and all the rest of it with the flexibility they've enjoyed for the last 10 years across dual campuses, university and TAFE. Again, it is a very significant issue, and with 70% of Labor's front bench in the federal parliament being former union bosses, the issue of union influence over future policy and direction and all of the rest of it will be front and square, and it is a very important issue on the table for you, for us, for the community, and it must be, I think, a really critical part of the next this forthcoming election. So, to summarise, we're fostering cultural change, which restores the standing of technical and vocational training. There's all sorts of ways we can do that, but a lot of it is what we say and how we approach it for our young and for all those throughout the workforce. And secondly, and most importantly, we're trying to drive responsiveness and flexibility, make it demand-driven, not supply-driven, and that involves TAFE autonomy, in my view. It involves the voucher approach, and it involves the building blocks that I talked about. Getting into the minds, and a lot of this is a cultural change, not just for the workforce or for the training providers, but for management. To embrace this is an important cultural change for all of us, and it's one that's critical. I think we do these things, I think we'll very ably cope with what's coming down the line. Thank you.